Let's go to chapter 17 now, which is about another pathway. We just got done with glycolysis. Now we're going to study what is really, functionally speaking, the reverse of glycolysis, which is gluconeogenesis. The genesis part of that word refers to the creation, right? The creation of glucose. Well, this is not the liberation of glucose from a storage polysaccharide like glycogen. At the end of the last chapter, when I was talking about the liver responding to low blood glucose levels by breaking down the glycogen it made earlier into the monomers that it's made out of, which is just glucose, and then putting that back into the blood, that's not gluconeogenesis, because you're not making glucose newly, which is what the neo part means. You're not making it out of something that's not glucose already. So that breakdown of glycogen, which the liver is important for doing to maintain glucose levels in the blood, that's called glycogenolysis. So don't confuse these terms. Glycogenolysis is the breakdown of glycogen. Glycolysis is the breakdown of sugar, glucose. Gluconeogenesis is creation of new glucose out of stuff that isn't glucose, isn't sugar to begin with. All right? Gluconeogenesis is another major function of the liver. And if you think about it in terms of just a one-shot summary from beginning to end, you know, like you can do with cellular respiration, you can say you start with glucose and you end up with CO2, right? That's, even though it doesn't happen in one shot, you can talk about a summary reaction. Well, the summary reaction for glycolysis is that you start with glucose, you end up with pyruvate, right? That's exactly the reverse of the summary reaction for gluconeogenesis. You start with pyruvate and you go to glucose. But importantly, gluconeogenesis isn't simply glycolysis happening in reverse, although that's partially true. Anyone know why it's partially true? Well, what do you know about glycolysis and its enzymes? Most of them are reversible, right? Highly reversible. It's just the three that we talk about as control points that are irreversible, right? So glycolysis and gluconeogenesis overlap wherever you have those reversible reactions. And the same enzyme works in both pathways at each of those points. It's just doing the reverse reaction instead. But at every one of those control points in glycolysis, which are irreversible reactions for that enzyme, the reverse process has to be catalyzed by a different enzyme that also works irreversibly, but in the reverse direction for gluconeogenesis. All right? And we'll look at it, the next slide will make that more clear. But this opening slide shows you what can happen to glycerol. Where do we get glycerol? What kind of lipids? Now, we don't get them from fatty acids. We get them from triacylglycerols, or fats. Right. So, consider the situation in which gluconeogenesis is necessary. When would you need gluconeogenesis? When you don't have glucose, right? And you need to make glucose, otherwise your brain, and therefore you, is going to die. Well, what is, besides carbohydrates, what is the other main fuel? Lipids, right? You can use carbohydrates, lipids, or proteins for fuel. Why don't you, under normal circumstances, use proteins? Yeah, because they're doing all kinds of other jobs, including making up your body. your skeletal muscles are very high in protein, right? So you could, if you needed to, under starvation conditions, break down your muscles. That's what wasting away is. Wasting away means you're out of your other two fuel sources, carbohydrates and fats. So you need to start breaking down muscle, because without glucose, the brain dies. The point here is that if you're out of sugar, then the next place to look without breaking down your muscles is your fat stores. And fats are triacyl glycerols. So each fat molecule is a glycerol connected to three fatty acyls. When a fat is digested, or when it's catabolized, it's broken down into its monomers, or its four parts. The three fatty acids on their own, which are free fatty acids, and then the glycerol molecule. Well, the free fatty acids are fuels in their own right, and they can be oxidized to make ATP. We'll talk about that pathway later. But what's left, when you exclude the fatty acids, is the glycerol molecule. And the glycerol molecule can easily go into the glycolytic pathway with a little bit of modification. Not only the glycolytic pathway, but the gluconeogenic pathway. Okay? Because they're shared, like I said. That's what's happening here in the first slide. This is glycerol. An enzyme called glycerol kinase does exactly what you would expect it to do based on its name. It phosphorylates glycerol, right? When that happens, you have glycerol phosphate, the middle one, and that's still not quite ready for either of these pathways, so you have to modify it into dihydroxyacetone phosphate. Okay? Now, notice that first step, glycerol kinase transforming glycerol into glycerol phosphate, it's a phosphorylation step, of course, and the source of the phosphate is one of the ones that are on ATP. So you have to spend energy to transform glycerol into a usable form for gluconeogenesis. So now we have the one phosphate on it. Then in the second step, which is catalyzed by glycerol phosphate dehydrogenase, the fuel itself, which is glycerol phosphate, gets dehydrogenated. The blue hydrogen gets stripped from it. Where does it end up? On the coenzyme, NAD. So that reduces NAD plus into NADH and H plus. So you spent some energy here, but you get some back right here, just in a different form. But more importantly, in terms of making glucose, which is the goal of gluconeogenesis, is that you make dihydroxyacetone phosphate, which you already know as a glycolytic intermediate, right? But not one of the ones that are involved with the control, the irreversible step. This is a reversible step. So if you have dihydroxyacetone phosphate, which can feed into the glycolytic pathway, that means it can also feed into the gluconeogenic pathway, because that's one part that they share reversibly. Well, in the second slide, we see an overall summary of gluconeogenesis. This is gluconeogenesis if you read it. Well, it is gluconeogenesis, but it proceeds from top to bottom. If you look at it, though, from bottom to top, it's very similar to glycolysis, right? The only difference are the pink parts, which, if this were glycolysis, would be those three control points. Like I said, for gluconeogenesis, the shared parts the parts that it shares with glycolysis are the reversible steps. But the controlled steps need to be done by entirely different enzymes that are just for gluconeogenesis. All right, so if you think about bottom to top conversion of glucose into pyruvate being glycolysis, and top to bottom being gluconeogenesis, then this first two steps of gluconeogenesis, the two pink steps at the top, those really replace the irreversible final step of glycolysis, right? What is that final step? Conversion of what into what? Well, you have the answer right there. The conversion of phosphoenolpyruvate into pyruvate would be the final step of glycolysis. What is that irreversible enzyme that does that job? Pyruvate kinase, exactly. So pyruvate kinase operates only in glycolysis in the upward direction. In the downward direction, in gluconeogenesis, that is replaced by two steps here. So there's two separate enzymes working in succession here. Pyruvate carboxylase first, and then phosphoenolpyruvate carboxykinase next. Those two do the reverse in gluconeogenesis of what pyruvate kinase does in glycolysis. And just like the irreversible final step in glycolysis is a control point, these first two steps that replace it in gluconeogenesis are an important control point for gluconeogenesis. Then all the blue ones are fully reversible, so they are exactly the reverse of glycolysis and use exactly the same enzymes in both processes. Now, when you get down to here, oh, by the way, there's a publisher's error here. This bracket, in the book it's okay, but in the slideshow, this bracket is missing the 2x, meaning that all this stuff happening down to this point occurs two times, which makes sense in terms of the reverse of glycolysis, right? Because glycolysis, you have a phase one, which is at the bottom going upward until you get to the fork, and then everything after that happens twice. Well, in the reverse of that overall process, you start with two times, and then instead of having a fork, you have a convergence, a coming together of two 3-carbon sugars into one 6-carbon sugar. That's what gluconeogenesis accomplishes. So the top half of this slide in gluconeogenesis would represent the reverse of stage 2 of glycolysis. And the bottom half of this represents the reverse of stage 1 of glycolysis. Okay? But we have the other two control points of glycolysis being replaced in gluconeogenesis by other enzymes farther down the line. This middle one, the control enzyme here is fructose 1,6-bisphosphatase. What is the enzyme that's being replaced, the glycolytic enzyme that's being reversed here? Whose action is being reversed? Phosphofructokinase, exactly. Remember that in glycolysis, phosphofructokinase transforms fructose 6-phosphate into fructose 1,6-bisphosphate. Just the reverse of that, the dephosphorylation of fructose 1,6-bisphosphate to leave just fructose 6-phosphate is what happens in gluconeogenesis under the action of fructose 1,6-bisphosphatase. Now this brings up another general definition. Phosphatases are enzymes that do exactly the opposite of kinases. Kinases phosphorylate things. Phosphatases dephosphorylate things. Whether that turns them on or off depends on the... If it's an enzyme, for instance, that depends on the situation. But that's... Phosphatases always dephosphorylate. Kinases always phosphorylate. Okay. The last control point in gluconeogenesis is at the bottom, but that corresponds to the first control point in glycolysis, right? So glucose 6-phosphatase, which is, notice it's another thing that is dephosphorylating, another phosphatase. What is that the reverse of? What enzyme is that the reverse of in glycolysis? Hexokinase, exactly. The first one to operate in glycolysis. Okay, so those control points are really what we want to concentrate on because we've already gone through all the blue ones. Those are reversible. We don't need to talk about those again. So the next several slides are just about these control points. Actually, slide 3 and 4 are just the same slide over except in the top part and the bottom part separated so we can look at them better. But notice these yellow bubbles that I haven't talked about. Glycerol we did talk about. Glycerol comes from fats that are broken down into free fatty acids and glycerol, and that can feed in right here. But another important precursor input into gluconeogenesis is lactate. So keep in mind what when you have lactate produced. Lactate gets produced in fermentation, right? Under anaerobic conditions, lactate gets produced. Lactate can't go on to cellular respiration, but that doesn't mean it's totally worthless. Lactate then can be used to make brand new glucose, which can then go through glycolysis, producing pyruvate that can then go into cellular respiration. Okay, so lactate isn't wasted once it's produced. It's recycled, but it takes some processing to do that. And that's another major job of the liver. It processes lactate that builds up because skeletal muscles are producing it in abundance when you are exerting yourself beyond the demands of your oxygen-carrying capacity. When your cardiovascular system can't deliver enough oxygen to run cellular respiration fast enough to keep up with the production of pyruvate, that pyruvate needs to be turned into lactate so that glycolysis can continue, right? Well, when that lactate gets built up, it ends up being sent to the liver so that the liver can make brand new glucose out of it. So that's that top arrow. Amino acids can be used as well, but like I said, that's usually not the case unless it's starvation. When you start using proteins, that means you've depleted these other important energy sources. Okay, let's then go to 5. Because 4 is just the bottom of that original figure, figure 2. Anyway, we're on 5. And if you remember, the first two steps of gluconeogenesis in pink are what replace just one step in glycolysis in reverse. So we're looking at that very first step right here, which is the production of oxaloacetate out of pyruvate. And notice that pyruvate is reacting with carbon dioxide to do this. Oxaloacetate receives that carbon dioxide. I mean, it has that carbon dioxide that's received by pyruvate. So this is a carboxylation of pyruvate. To carboxylate means to put a C and two O's on, right? The CO2 is listed here just as CO2, but in your body, most of your CO2 is not in the form of CO2. It's in the form of bicarbonate ion, because CO2 and water react to form carbonic acid, which then dissociates into hydrogen ions and bicarbonate ions, right? So most of your usable CO2 that's dissolved is in the form of bicarbonate. Anyway, it ends up being hooked on to pyruvate to make oxaloacetate. And pyruvate carboxylase is the enzyme responsible, which is a good name for it. It carboxylates pyruvate. By the way, this is one step in which ATP is spent in the process. But ATP is not being spent here to phosphorylate a fuel. ATP is just spent for this to happen. The hydrolysis of ATP is just going to make this inorganic phosphate now on its own in solution. So you've spent the energy, but that's necessary in order to get this intermediate, which is required for the rest of the pathway to continue. Speaking of that, let me temporarily go back to slide 2 just for a second. Notice ATP is being spent in the first reaction, all these ones down to here are happening twice. So you have 2 ATPs being spent up there. In the second, you have 2 GTPs, because it's happening twice as well, being spent. GTP is spending energy just like ATP is. And then you have 2 more spent right here. So for every glucose molecule that you make out of non-glucose substrates or non-carbohydrate substrates in gluconeogenesis requires expenditure of 6 ATP, or 6 nucleoside triphosphates, I should say. And why does that make sense? Because this is the reverse of glycolysis. glycolysis gets you a net gain of ATP, right? It releases energy. So the reverse of that process is going to require energy. And that energy is in the form of not only ATP and GTP, but NADH is spent right here in this step. Okay, let's go back to the details of this then. So I just went over slide 5. The second step is shown inside slide 6, and this is another publisher error. Anyone see it? The error is in the name of the enzyme. The second enzyme is not phosphoenolpyruvate carboxylase, it's phosphoenolpyruvate carboxykinase. The first enzyme to work, which is the previous slide, is a carboxylase. This next one is phosphoenolpyruvate carboxykinase, not carboxylase. And it's written correctly in the summary slide, slide 2, but it's wrong here. Anyway, what's happening here? The oxaloacetate that was just produced in the first step is now going to undergo phosphorylation and decarboxylation simultaneously. Okay, so that first step was a carboxylation step. You took the lactate, you took the pyruvate, and you carboxylated it. You added a CO2 onto it. Now, in the second step, you take that CO2 right back off. But it's necessary for it to work. Simultaneous with the decarboxylation, though, is the phosphorylation of this oxaloacetate. And that's what transforms it into, when you remove the CO2 and you add the phosphate, that transforms it into phosphoenolpyruvate. Okay? So these two first steps reverse the final step of glycolysis. Okay. And CO2 is liberated here, so it goes back into solution, basically, from where it started in the previous slide. Notice, though, that the source of the phosphoryl group is not ATP, it's GTP. GTP has a very similar phosphoryl transfer potential compared to ATP, and so it's able to transfer its phosphoryl to something with a lower potential, just like ATP does. But it works with certain enzymes, whereas ATP works with other enzymes. Now on to 7. The pyruvate carboxylase enzyme that starts the whole reaction, the whole glyconeogenic pathway, is an enzyme that requires a cofactor in order to operate. That cofactor is a vitamin called biotin. And that's really what we're looking at here in slide 7. All of this except the activated CO2 that's in its own box and this lysine residue that's down here at the bottom, the rest of that is biotin, which is a vitamin, and therefore you can't produce it. You have to get it from your diet. But it's important that you do, because without it being covalently bonded as a covalent cofactor to this carboxylase enzyme, then it won't work. The enzyme won't work, which means you can't proceed with gluconeogenesis, which is a big deal, right? So that's an important vitamin. But what it does is temporarily hang on to this CO2, this activated CO2, which the reason it's an activated CO2, you don't see it in this picture, but a CO2 from a bicarbonate ion in solution picks up a phosphate, and that makes it an activated CO2. It's really called carboxyphosphate at that point. But that carboxyphosphate is carried by the end of this biotin molecule that is hooked to the enzyme itself via this lysine. The lysine is part of the enzyme, but when that enzyme gets activated by the vitamin, it's now all one molecule because this is a covalent modification. So it's basically permanent on this enzyme. Well, that CO2, it gets transferred from one substrate to another, basically, in this process. in slide 8, we're just looking at the overall enzyme now, not just the biotin. So you see that lysine residue, which is one of the amino acids in the overall protein, the yellow ribbon. And then hanging off of that is the biotin, which has the ability to carry this activated CO2. Okay, slide 9. One thing I didn't mention yet about gluconeogenesis is that almost all of it, all of the steps in the pathway occur in the cytosol. But the first step and the final step do not. So that first step is the conversion of pyruvate into oxaloacetate, remember. That's the one that uses pyruvate carboxylase, the enzyme we just looked at. And that occurs in mitochondria. So what we have is a mitochondrion here. Pyruvate is being transformed into oxaloacetate by being carboxylated at the expense of ATP, right? That oxaloacetate, though, is not just directly delivered to the cytosol. Instead, it has to undergo some transformations via a shuttle system. So the oxaloacetate undergoes transformation into malate, as you see here. What kind of reaction is that based on this, what's shown here? What's happening to oxaloacetate? It's becoming reduced, exactly, because NADH, the reduced coenzyme, is giving up its hydrogen and its electrons, in other words, to oxaloacetate. So oxaloacetate gets reduced into malate, and that reoxidizes NADH into NAD+. That malate then is able to get out of the mitochondrion through a transporter in the membrane, membranes really, because it's a doubly membrane-bounded organelle. And then once you have malate out in the cytosol, basically the reverse happens. Malate gets reoxidized into oxaloacetate, which reduces NAD+ out in the cytosol back into NADH. All right, which is useful stuff, remember. Always remember NADH is carrying some energy for you. But now that we have oxaloacetate, even though it was not a direct process like we just looked at, that's the first major step. Pyruvate into oxaloacetate, and oxaloacetate now in the cytosol is where the rest of gluconeogenesis is going to occur until that final step, which I'll talk about when we get there. Let's go to slide 10, though. We've skipped over the reversible reactions that gluconeogenesis shares with glycolysis up until the next non-shared point, the next control point, in other words, which is what slide 10 is. So fructose 1,6 bisphosphatase, that is the enzyme that does the reverse of what glycolytic enzyme? Phosphofructokinase. Read this thing right to left. If you put a second phosphate on an already phosphorylated fructose, the enzyme responsible for doing that is phosphofructokinase, transforming it into fructose 1,6-bisphosphate. That would be glycolysis. This is gluconeogenesis, though. So the reverse process occurs, but with its own enzyme that is irreversible in the other direction. Why it says just single arrow, irreversible. So another major control point, this time a control point of gluconeogenesis. And that's fructose 1,6-bisphosphatase, which makes sense just because the substrate is fructose 1,6-bisphosphate, but also because it's acting as a phosphatase. It's stripping a phosphoryl group off of something. It's undoing what a kinase does, right? So it's acting as a phosphatase. And that's why we have inorganic phosphate now here on the right side. It used to be on the fuel. Okay, now slide 11 jumps to the end because the intervening stuff between slide 10 and slide 11 is just the reverse of glycolysis, so we're not going to mention that again. The ending point, though, like I said a few minutes ago, is another part of gluconeogenesis that does not occur in the cytosol. You start off in the mitochondria and go to the cytosol for almost all of it. And then in this final step, which involves the transformation of glucose-6-phosphate into free glucose, as it's called, just glucose that's on its own, not phosphorylated. That is done in the lumen of the endoplasmic reticulum. Lumen simply means the hollow interior of something. And it's catalyzed by a membrane-bound enzyme, an enzyme that is part of the ER membrane, represented by the pink thing here, that's associated with transport proteins situated nearby. So the glucose-6-phosphate, which is the what's produced in the penultimate or next-to-last step of gluconeogenesis, that's out in the cytosol. It gets transported through this transporter into the ER temporarily. Or I shouldn't say temporarily. It gets transported in. And that's where the phosphate gets stripped off by glucose-6-phosphatase. Once again, it's operating as a phosphatase by stripping a phosphoryl off. That leaves just glucose. But also that inorganic phosphate that used to be on glucose is now on its own. It doesn't stay in the ER lumen, though. It then goes out its own channel, as does the inorganic phosphate. So there's three channels involved here. One for bringing in the one substrate, and two for taking out the two products back into the cytosol. All right, now, well, I better stop there.